3. Dark side of the moon. The following week, I started feeling an increasing sense of warmth from Mr. McAfee. As much as we'd talked about him, and as much as he'd clearly relished the process of getting some early childhood memories off his chest, I always felt that it was a one-way process. One way, when you're trying to write a book about someone else's life, is usually how it has to be. There is, of course, little time for anything else, as much as a bit of mutual understanding certainly helps the collaborative process. However, if there was one thing I'd learned about McAfee in the few weeks that we'd been talking, it was that, as much as he had lived his life his own way, often to his detriment, other people were as much a part of the story as he was. He needed wives, many of them, and twice as many girlfriends and mistresses. He had friends at various levels, but more than either of those, he appeared to have a curiosity about and ultimately an affinity with total strangers he encountered, of which I was one. "Tell me, how well do you play the guitar, my friend?" he asked at the beginning of one of our calls, when he caught sight of a guitar in the background of my office. "Not well," I said. "I've tried at various times in my life to improve, but have rarely had the time." "What do you think of musicians like Peter Frampton and Eric Clapton?" he asked. "I like them. I'm a big fan of 70s music generally," I said. "I think Peter Frampton's Do You Feel Like We Do is the pinnacle of guitar mastery from that age," McAfee told me. "I have never heard anything quite like it." "I wouldn't disagree with that," I replied, wondering where the conversation was going. "It is still as fresh as it ever was, and in fact I'm going to use it as background music for the first video for my 2020 presidential election campaign," he explained. So that's where this was going, I thought to myself. "I'm having these people put together a video that'll be a compilation of every aspect of me, playing the piano, on the stage at the Libertarian National Convention, drunk, on a jet ski, carrying a bunch of weapons, smoking dope. I want this clip to be the complete package of me," he explained. "Sure, what's the point of it all?" I asked. "Well, obviously I'm not running for president. Everybody knows that. But I do want the national stage. But if I was running for president, I'd want them to know the bad as well as the good about me." I think what McAfee was trying to tell me was, on one hand, that he had many qualities that he saw as being worthy of illustrating, kind, funny, a great business manager, an engaging public speaker and so on. He was indeed all of these things. But on the other, he was telling me that he also knew what his own weaknesses were, a hard partier, lazy, an accomplished liar, a serial womanizer, and all the rest. What this revealing conversation made me think was that, while McAfee was undoubtedly an accomplished liar when required, or at the very least a habitual distorter of the truth, there was also a big part of him that, at the age of 74, badly needed the truth out there about his life. While a 12-minute campaign video for a mythical presidential run was one way of doing it, it also suggested to me that he saw our conversations, and the book that would result from them, as his one last chance at the truth, or at least as much of the truth as he was willing to part with. Having bailed on several other attempts to write about his life, why would he be bothering with our talks if he didn't really want people to know about him and understand what made him tick? So, on that basis, if you're willing to show all sides of you in a campaign video, does the same apply to our conversations? I asked him. Of course, unless there are immediate and terrible repercussions associated with anything I tell you, what you will get is total honesty. The only situation in which I'll have to be economical is if something I say could materially harm someone else. I don't want to do that. Anything else, I don't care. How do I know that you're telling me the truth? I asked. I'm 74 years old, my friend. At this point in life, I have no possible reason to do anything else, he replied. With that, we proceeded. Me. I assume you graduated from Roanoke College on time. John McAfee. Yes, I graduated in 1967 and soon took up a funded graduation assistantship program place at Northeast Louisiana State University in the fall of 1968. Here I would be teaching math classes to undergraduates while simultaneously studying for my own master's degree in mathematics. Me. Did teaching come naturally to you? John McAfee. It's hard to say. Shortly after I arrived in Monroe, Louisiana, I met one of my students, Lindsay, who sat in the front row of my class. She was this beautiful young blonde with nice legs. It didn't take long, like 15 minutes after the first class, for her to join me in bed. Before I could even finish my first quarter, I was thrown out of my assistantship for sleeping with one of my students. Remember, this was the South in 1968, an era of repressed sexuality and extreme morality. Teachers did not just casually sleep with their students and get away with it. I lost my assistantship, and with no willingness to pay my own way through an expensive college, I went back to Virginia, whereupon I enrolled at Virginia Polytechnic Institute in Blacksburg for the next quarter, which was 50 miles from where I had been living in Roanoke. Me. What happened to Lindsay? John McAfee. After less than a month, Lindsay came to Virginia to live with me, and from here my life started getting very complex. I had only attended class at Blacksburg for one quarter before I got a job with General Electric in Roanoke as a programmer trainee. I took the job just for summer, and I'm eternally grateful that I did. This was to be my first ever exposure to computers. Me. What did the computers look like in 1969? John McAfee. Number one, they were huge. They'd fill an entire room. By today's standards, they had zero power. However, even in 1969, they had immense power in comparison to the human brain in terms of their power to process information. Very quickly, I learned some very low-level but extremely important concepts about how hardware interfaced with software because I was working on something called process automation. Process automation was pretty much all that General Electric did at that time, and it was specifically designed for factories, canning companies, steel mills, and so on. And so I was tasked to create the system that automated Australia Iron and Steel's rolling mill in Port Kembla, New South Wales. Unfortunately, I did not get to finish that job because the end of the summer came and I started looking at my life and what I wanted to do with it. Me. What conclusions did you reach? John McAfee. One thing I was certain about was that I didn't want to go back to school. What I had learned in 3 months at General Electric was so much more valuable than the entirety of my college education up to that point. Computer programming is just math. Computers at that time were mathematics in a world where only two numbers, 0 and 1, mattered. Now, it really didn't matter what the numbers were, it was all still mathematics. 10, 20, or 16, like hexadecimal, one of the computer concepts, it wasn't important. To me, it was just a piece of cake, and the difference was because it was a job. I actually had to be there and apply myself every day. I learned more in those 3 months than I ever did at any other time in my life. And I didn't just do 8 hours a day. No, I went home at night and started playing with the computer instructions, finding out how everything worked. I was fascinated. I was drawn in by an absolutely random summer job. It was the fulcrum point of my life. Me. Did you ever go back to Blacksburg? John McAfee. At the time when I was meant to go back, I sat down and said to myself, wait a minute. I've achieved more in computer science in a little town in Virginia than I ever could have elsewhere. This was all true. However, as much as I'd mastered some of the principles of process automation, I also knew that process automation itself was only a tiny corner of computer science, even as it existed at that time. I yearned for more, so what I did was think of the company I most wanted to work for in the whole world, and the first name that sprang to mind was NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. I was a science nut with a taste for fantasy. What other company was going to fit the bill? Me. True, but this sounds like an ambitious idea for a guy with just 3 months' experience at General Electric. John McAfee. It was, and I didn't just want to work at NASA, I wanted to work at the Institute for Space Studies, which was located on the campus of Columbia University in Manhattan, New York City. So I dummied up a resume that gave me 3 years more experience than I actually had, sent it in, and lo and behold, I scored an interview. I had lied, true, but I also banked on them not checking my references, just for the purposes of an initial interview. I thought, why would they fucking bother? It was a risk worth taking. I just wanted to get myself in the fucking door so that I could sit down in front of the person who was going to say yes or no. If I could get that far, I knew I had the ability and the charisma to get that job, and that's exactly what happened. Me. How exactly did you wing an interview at NASA? John McAfee. I was asked some serious shit in that interview, but thank God it was all stuff that I could answer coherently at the time. Not only could I answer these questions, but I found a way to add to these solutions by offering further ideas and suggestions. They must have been sitting there thinking, hell, we had never even thought of that. Me, did they ever check your references? John McAfee, either they didn't check them, as I hoped they wouldn't, or they did check them and it didn't fucking matter that they were bogus because I so blew away the interviewer that they couldn't not give me that job. Anyhow, within days I was packing up my shit and moving to New York City, while the girl, Lindsay, reluctant to make the big change in lifestyle, went back to Louisiana. I found myself an apartment, started the job, and for one solid year and a half, I was in heaven. I was working with not only the top minds in New York or even America, but also the top minds in the fucking world were right there with me. The people who were planning the mission to the moon, missions to Mars, and planning our entire satellite program. All of the most senior architects were right there, and I felt like I was in Fat City because I was a part of it. Me. Having got the job by lying, how did you manage to keep winging it? John McAfee. Yes, I had the capability, and I'd proved that during the interview, and kept proving myself thereafter. My first job within the program was related to the Tyros-1 weather satellite, which had been up in space since its launch in April 1960. Ever since then, for almost 10 years, it had been sending back data non-stop, 24 hours of every day. But we did not have the technology to process any of this data properly. And then the IBM 360 came out, the first general-purpose, large-scale computer. It had about the power that the average smartphone has today, but instead of being 6 inches long, it covered almost an entire floor of a massive building. That was my tool. Then they gave me all the data from Tyros-1 and said, "Is there anything that can be done here? We haven't figured out how to process all of this yet." Me. So what did you do to solve their problem? John McAfee. Well, the first thing I thought was, what am I fucking going to do with this? Half of this data was coming back in pre-digital, analog form. There were years of this stuff. The task seemed overwhelming. But the first thing I actually did was spend a week taking drugs and walking the streets of New York City day and night. Me. Why drugs and why then? John McAfee. This was 1969, arguably the most symbolic year of all for drug experimentation. I was in New York when Woodstock was happening. Everybody was talking about it. Everybody was curious about drugs. I'd already done a bunch of drugs before 1969. I'd already tried LSD and all manner of other psychedelics. For me, drugs, no matter what they were, put me in a different state of perspective. I'm not saying it was always the proper state or even a real state, but equally, sometimes it was. So I spent that week just sleeping little, cogitating, drawing schematics, writing notes, and then finally, huh, it's a piece of cake. I had the solution. I then went back to my office, wrote a program, presented it, and that program is still cranking away at the Tyros-1 weather satellite today as we speak. My Tyros-1 work got me the accolades to write my own tickets to any programming job I ever wanted. And in the short term, it proved to my bosses at NASA that I was legitimate, which meant I could keep the job as long as I wanted it. Unfortunately, it turned out only to be for a year and a half. Me, why, what happened? John McAfee. Well, Lindsay, the girl who had left, had come to New York a few times to see me and had gotten pregnant. Allegedly, it was my kid, she said. And at that time, because we didn't have synthetic paternity testing, a man just had to take the woman's word for it. Regardless, whether the child was mine or not was immaterial. I stepped up, left New York, where I'd made a lot of money, and moved to Tennessee to marry Lindsay, have a family, and in theory, to start a completely new life. Me. Was there a particular reason you chose Tennessee? John McAfee. Bear in mind at this point I was walking around with a serious NASA resume. Programmers in 1970 were absolute the gods of money. We were some of the highest paid people in the professional world, assuming that you consider programming to be a professional occupation. We could ask anything of anybody at that time. I could have got any job I wanted. UNIVAC, a company that hasn't existed since the late 1980s, was the second largest computer company in America at that time. And their engineering and development plant was in Bristol, Tennessee, which also happened to be where my mother lived at the time. Bristol is a strange concept. Half of it is in Tennessee, the other half is in Virginia. One city, two states. Anyway, there I was in Bristol, Tennessee, married with a young baby daughter, and I started working at UNIVAC. Like I had at NASA, I did a great job, and it was there that I finally learned how to write operating systems for computers, the fundamental underlying brain on top of which all applications, etc., ran. Back in those days, this was laborious, complicated work. Even to get something to print, a whole program had to be written just to be able to interface with a printer at all. Those programs then became part of the operating system. Me. So are we talking about the era of the C prompt here? John McAfee. Laughter. The C prompt didn't appear until we had actual computer screens, where we could actually see something on there using a keyboard. It would be another 25 years until that shit hit the world, and it only existed in its capacity as an icon for Microsoft's DOS operating system anyway. I was working on front panels on these machines in 1970. I literally threw switches on and off. It was primitive work. Then, a little later, we got punch cards, and boy, did that feel like a miracle. Instead of writing a program out in machine code and then going to the front panel to set the switches according to these instructions, punch cards allowed you to write these instructions out, and these weren't instructions like print, these were if A plus B, etc., and then you could just feed those cards into the computer, and the instructions could be set from the cards. This was one of the biggest advancements in computer programmer interfaces. Me. Were you happy in this new family setup? John McAfee. Wait a minute. You're getting a little deeper than I thought you were going to get today. Me. It's not especially deep. It was a straightforward question. Do you not want to talk about it? John McAfee. Okay, well, like all people, the answer was yes and no. Of course, no matter where we are, we make our own happiness. I've been in jails and prisons, and I've seen people in there make their own happiness. So a better question might have been, would I have changed my situation had I had the courage? Me. That's fine. Why not answer that question instead? John McAfee. Yes, I would have changed it, absolutely. For a while, everything was fine, and then things weren't fine, simply because Tennessee was not Manhattan. The culture I'd acclimated myself to for that year and a half was the total opposite of Tennessee, the nature of which was reserved with a very fundamental Christian set of moralities. The truth of the matter was that I was just not cut out to be tied down into a marriage where I was expected to conform to a set of norms that denied the better part of me, especially not in rural Tennessee as it was then. However, at the time I accepted it, like we all accept what we think is the inevitable. But these things are never really inevitable. As human beings, we are masters of our own ship, and that, my friend, is the only thing we are masters of. That was especially true of me, and any time I tried to be the master of anyone other than me, I only got fucked over royally. Interfering in other people's lives for my own benefit was something I never felt I had the right to do. Me. Did you feel that this seemingly happy family life was temporary? John McAfee. Well, I had a wife, my daughter, and a good job. On that level, things were fine. But as I mentioned earlier, the environment that I was in Tennessee, never really fit with the values that I had in 1971. And then, as if to confirm that, I got arrested for dealing drugs. It was a huge deal in the local newspapers, and given that this was Tennessee, my bosses at UNIVAC took a very moralistic view of everything and fired me on the spot. This judgmental view came all the way down from the top, I was told. Suddenly I was jobless and facing the possibility of years in prison. So I contacted my attorney uncle, Carl McAfee, to represent me at trial, and somehow, thanks to him, the felony charges were dropped. Nevertheless, I was left with a misdemeanor for possession and still had to leave town in early 1972, pretty much with my tail between my legs. Me. Why did you deal drugs at all when you had a well-paying job? John McAfee. Habit? I don't fucking know. It was just fun for me, even to meet interesting people. Working at a place like UNIVAC, I was working with folks who in no way had anything in common with me, other than the work. So I dealt drugs to keep in touch with the underbelly of society, which is more than often the source of revolution, new ideas in politics, and everything else. I've always kept in touch with these folks. Me. So you left town with your wife and daughter. What was the plan thereafter? John McAfee. At this point, I definitely took my responsibilities seriously. We travelled to St. Louis, Missouri, where I took a job as programming manager for the Missouri Pacific Railroad, which was, at that time, automating all their rail car movements. This was one of the biggest challenges in all of the industry. Even in 1972, they probably had 10,000 cars, all of them moving in different directions on different trains. My job was to automate all this so that the computer could work out the best and most economically efficient routes. As opposed to my work with Australia Iron and Steel, where we were automating the machinery based on feedback we were getting from the steel rollers, at Missouri Pacific Railroad, we were automating the people controlling the cars. Me. Did you continue dealing drugs in St. Louis? John McAfee. I wasn't dealing so much, but I was certainly heavily into taking drugs at that time. I'd be taking all kinds of different shit and wasn't really feeling anything. So one night, in the apartment we were renting, I took an overdose of something my friends claimed was DMT, which was meant to be like a powerful, naturally occurring equivalent to LSD. All I really remember was that it was an orange colour. It wasn't just a mild overdose either, this was massive. The long and short of it was that I basically lost contact with all reality for 3 months. I lost my job, which was highly embarrassing. I lasted a few days, but it must have been apparent to everyone that I no longer knew what the function of my job was. The program might as well have been spitting out railcar routes to Mars. Then, after about a week, when I walked in one morning, everybody was just staring at me. I don't know why. I don't think I was naked, but at that point, I could easily have been. But I must have looked crazy. A friend of mine who also worked at the company and had supplied me drugs at various times in the past was sent into my office to deal with me. This dude talked to me for a while, established that he didn't need to call the police or to hospitalize me, and then calmly walked me to the door while everyone just stared. I got in my car, drove away, and that was the last I ever saw of the Pacific Railroad job. They had no choice but to fire me. Me. Do you remember what it felt like when you took this drug? John McAfee. I was sitting around this table with these friends in the apartment. We all took a little. I assume everyone else was tripping. But initially, I didn't feel anything. Then I snorted a bit more, and then a bit more for good measure. I just kept doubling my dose until I felt something, because that's how I approach things. When the drug came on for real, the table started spinning in a DNA type of spiral going upwards. Then we all climbed on top of this table, whereupon it shot up through the roof and into the stratosphere. We were all desperately just clinging onto this table. These were my perceptions of reality, and it got stranger from there. Honestly, it was 3 months until I could recognize a semblance of normality. Even today, I still struggle with it at times. Me, what were you actually doing during these last 3 months? John McAfee. Eventually, unable to deal with me, Lindsay took our daughter and drove back to Virginia to stay with my mother. Meanwhile, I stuck out the aftermath of this trip alone in the apartment. I got crazy, and I mean scary crazy. That's how bad it was. People were calling and stopping by. Apparently, I hadn't shaved or showered for days or weeks. Eventually, getting desperate, I called that old flame Alexa. I'd been calling her all the time, and eventually she just said, "Don't worry, I'll come to St. Louis. You need help." So she came to St. Louis, and yes, I was married with a daughter, and yes, I was now cheating on my wife with an ex-girlfriend. However, one night, she and I were sitting on the sofa listening to Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon, which is still one of my favorite albums today. It's hard to explain this, but as I was sitting there, I felt like I went through an entire lifetime before being shocked back to the sofa again. Then I went through another lifetime, and then I'd be shocked back to the sofa again. At one point, I left Alexa and went out to downtown St. Louis. I have no idea why. I felt that everybody was after me or something bad was happening. Meanwhile, I was scurrying around, paranoid, hiding behind trash cans in back alleys. If anyone came anywhere near me, I'd dig deeper in. Then suddenly, from this position behind a dumpster, I had this feeling that I had to find a certain person, I don't know who. But I got it into my head that they might be in this bar around the corner. So I very slowly peered in the window of this bar and then backed up a little, and then I edged closer again. Pretty soon, people started looking at me, and when I finally summoned the courage to walk in the door, two people stood up. I thought, fuck me, I'm in a dangerous situation here, and instinctively picked up the phone book that was sitting beside the payphone at the door and started leafing through it. Lo and behold, it was no longer in alphabetical order. That's how fucked up I was. As I read these names, with G somehow before C, etc., I thought, I have made a serious mistake. I have walked into a place of great evil. I have no recollection of getting home that night. That was just one episode. I lived multiple lifetimes and I had flashbacks for years afterward, the most recent of which was in a bank in Woodland Park, Colorado in 2004. Me, what happened on that occasion? John McAfee. I was standing in line playing around with one of the little calculators. All of a sudden, I thought the digits on the calculator screen were showing my social security number, and in that moment, it felt like someone had tapped me on the shoulder, and I was right back in St. Louis, Missouri, on the sofa. I grabbed the podium and started screaming, "No, no," or wild-eyed, like an absolute madman. The manager came out and ushered me into an office to calm down. Thank God I had millions of dollars at that time, or else I'd have probably been put in some kind of asylum. Anyway, gradually I got a grip and realized that nothing bad was actually happening to me, by which time the busy bank had completely emptied, and I was then led back to the window to finish my business. That was the last time I flashed back in a major way. Me? Knowing what you know about drugs, did this trip alter the wiring in your brain? John McAfee. If it didn't, I don't know what the fuck was happening during those 3 months. The pivotal experience of all of this time was that I went through the most hellish periods of introspection. The drugs force you to do that shit. You are made to look at the raw, gory facts of you, and I don't mean the superficial shit you show to the world, where people might have looked at me and thought, he's a nice guy, has a decent job, loves his family, has a kid. No, none of that shit was on the table. I had to look at the real me. The resentments, the flaws, the insecurities, the secret desires, and the twisted wishes that I'd never acknowledged. I had to live with all this for 3 fucking months. Me, I've never taken drugs, so would you say psychedelics are synonymous with paranoia? John McAfee, not as a rule, no. It's usually stimulants, methamphetamines, and to a lesser extent, cocaine that will bring on paranoia. If you use crystal meth, for example, as I have done in recent years, you will develop severe paranoia within 3 or 4 months. Some people can deal with that, others can't. With psychedelics, massive overdoses and bad trips happen. I've gone through as many hellishly introspective trips as I have blissfully happy ones over the years. Me, would someone like me enjoy an LSD trip? John McAfee. Well, it is a potluck what kind of trip you might have, which is why I don't recommend that anyone take drugs, even though I have at various times. And if you are insistent on experimenting with psychedelics, don't do it alone, and never do it with a stranger. Do it with somebody you know who has taken 15 pounds of them and knows all of the potential outcomes. You need someone with you who knows the ropes a little and can recognize that when you're saying that you feel that you can fly and are standing on the edge of a roof about to try, they can say, "No, sir, you don't want to do that. Step down." Me. Anyway, back to St. Louis. What happened after these last 3 months? John McAfee. Do I really want to tell you this? Well, okay, as long as you're giving me the right to review this at a later date. Me. Sure, we'll decide whether it serves the story or not, but you make the ultimate call, it's your life. John McAfee. At this point, I'd pretty much stopped taking my mother's calls because she didn't seem to be helping any. She'd been in almost constant contact, wondering what the fuck was going on with me. Then one day I picked up and she was pleading for me to come home. She made all kinds of assurances, promised that nobody was going to be judged, etc., so I agreed to go back. However, bear in mind I was still crazy. I was not in touch with reality whatsoever, and in fact still doubted my own reality. I'd been so introspective for so long that I'd gone beyond myself and into the universe. I reached a point where I was crying because God, if there was a God, was alone. I got in the car and started driving to Virginia, and I was so deranged that when someone on the radio said, "Drink Coca-Cola," I immediately had to pull off the freeway and search for a place to buy a Coke. These weren't suggestions, these were commands. I genuinely believed that God was now talking to me through the car radio. That's how far off the map I was. Along the way, I picked up 2 hitchhikers. I have no idea what I said or did, but within 2 or 3 minutes, they were fucking begging me to stop the car and let them out. I was on a fucking freeway at the time. There was nowhere to stop. Please, stop the car, now. I hadn't threatened them. I didn't have a gun. I had nothing. But I clearly wasn't acting normally. But when I arrived in Bristol, I knew exactly what I was going to do. Me? Which was? John McAfee. I was going to kill my mother, my wife, and my baby daughter because God had told me to. It's important that you don't judge me here, my friend. In my mind, this was the only thing I could do. Me? Are you serious? You were actually going to kill them? John McAfee. At the time, that's what I felt compelled to do, yes. So I pulled into the driveway at my mother's house on a nice quiet street in a nice rolling hill suburb of Bristol, Virginia, where there were lots of trees, grass and flowers. I opened the door of the car, a white Chevrolet station wagon, by the way, and as I got out, a man came walking across the yard straight toward me. "Sir, do you believe that you have to be reborn into the kingdom of heaven?" he asked. "Fuck yes," I said. This was the first fucking person in 3 months that I actually felt like I could talk to. We went up on the porch and sat on the porch swing and talked. Meanwhile, thank God, my wife and mother had the common sense to leave it be and let me talk to this man. We swung for 2 hours while they looked out of the window at us from time to time, and for those 2 hours he imparted the whole impact of the Holy Bible. In my perception at that time, and it wasn't a specifically Christian perception, everything he was saying made total sense. Me. Why did this man's presence have so much impact at that time? John McAfee. I don't know. I guess those 2 hours were all I needed. When he left, I didn't want his pamphlet. I had no desire to either go to church or to go out on the street begging people to accept Christ into their lives. None of that shit appealed. All it did was get me to a place where I said to myself, was I really so crazy that I thought about killing my mother, my wife, and my daughter? So I came into the house in peace. Confused as fuck? Yes. But I was at peace because I had connected with one other fucking human being who understood. Me. Did you stay in Bristol? John McAfee. I did for a while because being with my mother also gave me peace. My wife, not so much. With hindsight, I think she was fucking with me. She'd say things like, I just bought this beautiful picture of an owl today. Is it okay if I put it in our bedroom? Well, what I saw was a picture not of an owl, but of a fucking elephant. Many years later, I went back to check, and it was indeed an elephant. I don't know what her motives were, but that picture has always been an elephant. Me. Did reality return gradually? John McAfee. It certainly did not return overnight, my friend. In some senses, it is still returning to me even now, 40 years later. However, I was in Bristol for a month or so until I reached a point where I felt I was able to put enough of the pieces of a new reality together to function somewhat. However, to continue to reassemble a new existence, I knew I had to be working. I got a job working for Xerox in Rochester, New York. At that time, Xerox had been putting out computer systems, and it hadn't been going very well. So they hired me to develop the operating system for a new Xerox computer. I went to Rochester with my wife and daughter, was there for God knows how long, and it was during this time that I started gaining a degree of worldwide notoriety, not in the mainstream press, but in the upper echelons of the high-tech world. Me. Was your marriage stable at this point? John McAfee. Not especially, and that wasn't helped by the fact that Xerox wanted to send me to London to a branch where they were developing the hardware so that we could test the hardware and the software in the same place. Initially, I had pushed back on the whole idea because my wife refused to go to London. I actually turned the job down to start with. Okay, how about we fly you back first class every weekend so that you can spend them with your family? Fuck yes, I can do that, I told them. And for the next 6 months, I spent weekdays in London and weekends in Rochester. And then my marriage fell apart, as marriages do. There were a variety of reasons, none of them significant. However, my wife took my daughter and moved back to Louisiana, while I quit Xerox and moved to California. Me. Why California? John McAfee. I wanted to live in LA. It was that simple. Everyone should live in LA at some point in his or her life, if at all possible. So I got a job, and this is crazy, with the Great American Insurance Company, in an office where they were doing all their processing for their insurance policies. In all honesty, I didn't particularly give a shit what the job was. I just wanted to go to LA, and they were willing to pay me a fortune and offer me an immediate start. So now I was by myself. Well, not quite. While I was living in London, I'd cultivated a love affair with a South African woman who worked in the South African embassy in Trafalgar Square. It wasn't long before she came to live with me in LA. Things were heavenly. That is, until the company decided to close the office and move the whole operation to their head office, which was located in Cincinnati, Ohio. Me. Did you want to leave LA having just got there? John McAfee. Hell no. However, I had not finished the job with the system they hired me to create, so as much as I didn't want to move to Cincinnati, I wanted to finish the job I'd started much more. I went to Cincinnati, rented a two-level, three-bedroom house in a nice suburb. It was a nice house. I was earning a fortune. Meanwhile, the lady from South Africa returned to South Africa. I then bought a motorcycle and started living the life of a free single man in his 30s. Me? Until? John McAfee, there is always that until moment, isn't there? Well, I was travelling on a bus one day and I met this girl. Olivia, her name was. What I remember most about this meeting was that while I was sitting behind her, I was just fascinated with her hair. It was like a lion's mane, and the whole energy that she emitted was like fire. She was 3 inches taller than me. Obviously, we got together, and a couple of months later, we both decided, fuck the corporate world, this makes no sense. I had plenty of money, and we bought a van, a 1969 converted Chevrolet hippie van, with a bed, windows, and everything fixed up for living and travelling. We decided to go back to California. On the way, we really enjoyed this van life. We were smoking weed, taking other drugs, and then somehow, we ended up taking some major detours. And the next thing I knew, we were in fucking Mexico. At that point, I remember saying to Olivia, you know, there's actually no hurry to get back to California.